Okay, today we're going to do something a little bit different. We've got a interview with a couple of record collectors about their experience of buying vinyl from Japan. It's all in English today, and the interview is by James Gaunt, who is the author of the book Making Science Fiction. He's speaking with Dave from DJShadowReconstructed.com and Brian from BeastieMania.com. So if you're interested in going deep on Japanese culture and language, please hit the subscribe button, and it's over to James.
We've all probably collected something in our life, whether it's stamps, Pokemon cards, or weird creepy dolls. But while I was in Japan recently, a friend asked me to look for some records for them. Don't they have records where you live, I thought? What's the difference between the records in Japan and at the secondhand stores back home? Rather than question my friend's lifestyle choices, I instead decided to speak with two experts in the field of record collecting to get to the bottom of this. Some collectors will focus on a specific record label or genre, while others have refined their focus down to one artist. This is the case for Dave, a collector from the UK who collects everything related to DJ Shadow. So how did Dave get hooked?
I guess I've always been a bit of a collector. As a kid, I used to collect things, toys, to key fobs, to postcards, stamps, that sort of thing. And then I started to sort of buy a lot of CDs and things in my teenage years. And then I guess my actual DJ Shadow collection, probably not until probably about 2006, I don't think, when I started to really collect.
Was it one album or CD in particular that made you want to start the collection?
But I think what started it was I was getting more and more into Shadow, and I was looking to try and track down every track in its physical form, whether it be on sort of vinyl or CD. So then that started me on the sort of road to buying multiple versions of things. So like a different copy of Introducing, for example, for the Influx bonus track or whatever, or a CD single just to pick up the obscure remix and things. So that's sort of where it kicked off. And then I remember I bought one of the jukebox toys. I don't know if you've seen those. So I bought one on eBay, I think it was, and the seller threw in a copy of Stem. It sort of then was, actually, this is quite cool. And I started to like pick up other little pieces here and there. And then before you know it, it's blown up.
I next spoke to Brian from Australia, who also goes by the name Astro B-Boy. With a nickname like that, it will come as no surprise that Brian collects hip-hop and Astro Boy merchandise. Or at least he did. Because as he told me, he no longer collects. But first, when did he start collecting?
When it comes to records, I guess it started when I was like 15 or 16. I was really into the Beastie Boys, and a secondhand CD record store near my school had a copy of She's On It. That single was not released on License to Ill, so I sort of needed that song, you know, to complete my collection at the time. So, you know, I naively thought that I'd have every song by the band. Didn't even know that it was the punk singles before that, but, you know, I was pretty happy when I had that record. And that's what started me down the collecting route. So when I purchased this single, it's just for that one song. And yeah, I was pretty happy. Then, you know, after collecting 500 Beastie Boys records later, or, you know, CDs and records, yeah, it sort of got a bit out of control.
So what made you stop collecting records?
At the time, I was moving around a lot. I was renting, and then the owner would sell up, and so I'd have to move. And this happened to me 3 or 4 times in a row. And as you can imagine, records weigh a lot. When we moved, I'd always want to take the responsibility of moving all the records myself. Mm-hmm. And going up and down stairs. I think after one of the last moves, I went, fuck this. It was also getting to a point, I suppose, where I'd research, buy the record, get it, file it away. I wasn't even listening to it. It was more about the collecting than the music. I started out enjoying, you know, it was more about enjoying the music, and then it was more about enjoying the physical medium. And it's like, I don't need that. So I sold off the collection. It's funny, I still go into record stores now and then, and it's like an ex-junkie going back into, into a crack den or something. It's like, oh, wow, that's pretty cool. You know, no, I don't need that. I don't have to buy that now.
Yeah.
And I think that's the other thing. When you're a completist and you're buying records, another thing will come out. You have to buy it. If you don't buy it now, and might not be able to buy it later, or you're going to buy an inflated price, I have to buy it now. So you feel obliged, and that's got to be boring, to be honest.
Records are pressed all around the world. So what makes Japanese pressing so interesting?
You sometimes get some exclusive artwork. For example, the Preemptive Strike compilation has a unique artwork on there. But most of the time, it's the bonus tracks. and then the things like the Obi strip and stuff.
An Obi strip? For those not in the know, an Obi is a piece of paper which comes wrapped around one edge of most Japanese pressings of CDs and records. This is a feature which started in the 1980s and has continued through to today. The Obi often features information such as the album's release date, price, translated title, and sometimes advertisements for other albums by the band. The Obi also features on video game and book packaging, and is often sought after by collectors who are looking for a complete original package. So I asked Dave, would you pay more for an Obi strip, and do you mind if the Obi is missing?
I think that's probably the collector in me, the completionist in me, is always looking for complete items and as mint as possible. So I think if something's rare and I'm struggling to find it, then I'll be happy to pick it up without the strip. But if it's a fairly common item, I would probably be leaving the ones that don't have it. And that's just purely because in my eyes, it's not a complete item. Ideally, I'd want everything that came with it, you know, whether it's an insert, some stickers, whatever it might be. I don't think it rests easy in the collection until it's, you know, fully formed in its complete state. Without that, it sort of acts as a placeholder and it'll always be looking for an upgrade. I think that's just the completionist, the collector in me that sits like that.
What about Brian? Would he pay more for an Obi strip?
Back at the height of my collecting, I probably would have, just to have that complete package. Mm-hmm. But I'm ashamed to say when I first got my first few Japanese CD singles, I threw away the Obi. What's this piece of paper? I don't need this, you know, throw it away.
So while Japan has Obi strips, bonus tracks and translated lyric sheets in a lot of their releases, are there other countries which have their own exclusives or quirks?
Well, I mean, Central and South American vinyl pressings, like say Mexico, Peru, Venezuela, they often have the tracks listed in Spanish, which is, you know, that's a little quirk. That's sort of cool. And not that I collected any myself, but back in the Soviet days, they were cutting records onto old x-rays, which is amazing. The sound quality would have been awful.
While looking through record stores in Tokyo recently, I found some Beastie Boy items I'd never seen before. Naturally, I thought I'd discovered some rarities, but when I checked on websites such as Discogs and Beastie Mania, I found out there were bootlegs. Bootlegs are records which aren't officially licensed by the bands. Sometimes they might be interesting and collect rare tracks together, but other times they are shoddy productions which are intended to rip off fans. So I asked Dave what he thinks of bootlegs.
Occasionally I'll pick up a bootleg if it's not available in another way. Recently I've been on some Japanese proxy sites and picked up a bootleg of Diminishing Returns on vinyl. Reason for that is it's just not available in that format in other ways. So I think there's some merit in that as a collector because it gives me a different way of listening to that music. Generally I don't pick them up too much unless maybe there's something funny about them, like they're so poorly done or designed, which this is plenty of. I don't have too much of an objection to it. Unless, of course, the bootleg is sort of pretending to be something that it isn't, like it's got DJ Shadow's name on it and pretends to be a Shadow record or track when it's got nothing to do with Shadow. Yeah. I think that's like, you know, that's just deception. That's the bootlegger trying to make a quick buck off someone else's name, which is in my mind slightly worse than someone just blatantly ripping off something that's officially been released. I genuinely do think there's probably some genuine bootlegs out there. I think given the nature of how Shadow makes his music, the sampling, I think it's almost certain that some of the stuff out there that is or may have been released by him, because if he'd done it in a legitimate way, then, you know, the music may never have seen the light of day just due to sample clearance and things.
So like, for example, the Brain Freeze series.
Yeah, so Brain Freeze is a bit of an awkward one in that most of the Brain Freeze stuff that you'll find out there is bootleg. Yeah, it was self-released, the legitimate versions anyway, mostly available from tour merch stores and things.
One aspect that collectors enjoy about Japan is the condition of the items. Stores in Japan are filled with records from all around the world, and yet even the second-hand ones from the 1980s are often in perfect condition. As someone who's been to Japan, I asked Brian why this is.
I'm wondering if it's a cultural thing. I mean, I'm going to generalize here, but I've found that Japanese people are just some of the friendliest people in the world. Always polite, rarely obnoxious, always extremely helpful. I don't know, is it that people appreciate their belongings more in Japan? I'm not sure. But whenever I received a parcel from Japan, it was always, and I mean always, immaculately packaged. The record would be carefully wrapped in newspaper, expertly sealed. Everything was so cool compared to when, you know, sometimes I get records from around the world and it's like someone took a drag from their cigarette, blew a plume of smoke in it, and then sealed it up and sent it to me. You know, if you're going to buy something and it's from Japan, you know it's going to arrive in awesome condition anyway.
Has record collecting become easier thanks to the internet? And are there negative aspects to collecting online, such as do you think it's made prices higher now?
It's definitely changed a lot. So when I started out, obviously there's no internet. So you relied on things like record collector magazine, record fairs, your local store, just friends for information. I remember getting record lists mailed out to me and you'd scan through it, find what you wanted, get some cash, put it in an envelope, hope the postman doesn't find the cash on the way they send it, and then hope your seller's actually going to send you the records and admit that they got the cash. And then, you know, there's things like there was no such thing, obviously, as Spotify, YouTube. So if you're looking and you go, this record might be cool, you don't even know what it sounds like. So you're taking a lot more punts, I suppose, you know, just giving it a try and see what happens. I mean, when I first logged onto eBay, and that was 98, there was one page of Beastie Boys stuff. And I had a look today because I was curious, and up came 4,000 items. So, you know, in that regard, it's pretty easy to track down items. But I know a lot of collectors, the hunt is part of the main attraction. So when it's all delivered on a silver platter, it gets a bit boring.
I asked Dave the same question.
Yeah, it definitely makes it easier. And I think there's different reasons for that. So, like, of course, the internet is a great place to buy and sell. You know, that really, it really opens the door up from that point of view. You get to see things you may never have seen before or have access to things you may never have seen before. It's more accessible. So it's easier in that regard. I'd also say that, like, social media as well has sort of opened things up. You know, I'm talking to people through Instagram who I may never have spoken to before, or never connected with in even the normal internet forums and things. And that's opened doors to getting things. People have sent me gifts, which is, you know, incredible. People have offered to sell me stuff that I may never have seen previous or never been able to get hold of. So that's made it a lot easier. The negative side, I guess, is the sort of the prices, you know, people flipping and scalping. A lot of prices seem to get inflated if someone thinks it's rare or there's only one of them. Some stuff that is legitimately, genuinely rare, demo tapes and things, people have been asking for thousands and thousands of pounds for them, you know, more than some really rare Beatles items would sell for. The internet just inflates the price. People think it's rare, so therefore it must be expensive. The flipping side of things, the scalpers, is frustrating because you sometimes get some limited edition releases and those releases might not be particularly accessible. They might be only available on Shadow's website for a few hours on American time, released in the middle of the night for me. So and you don't know that they're coming, or you might find that they're released only in a store for his, you know, annual garage sale. Those type of things tend to get snapped up by people going to the store in their droves. You know, I've seen people pick up multiple copies of stuff and then try and sell them online for crazy money the next day. I don't have any issue with people being entrepreneurial. The issue is more is that it just makes it so much less accessible for other people. So it means that I'm going to either have to pay over the odds or go hunting for it more. So it swings and roundabouts. If it's really limited, it can be disappointing and frustrating. Most things, though, to be fair, you know, are able to find just with time and a bit of patience, you can get it at a reasonable price. The only time I genuinely thought I would never find one, probably like, I reckon back in 2010, there was some releases of Death Surrounds Us that was just being placed into record stores. Shadow okay. was popping in with some unique artwork on the cover. I thought, I'm never going to find one of these. There's only 100 of them in existence. You know, some of them surface onto the internet and they just, price is crazy.
So you mentioned that you're a bit of a completionist. Does it frustrate you when there's multiple versions of the same album with either different tracks or different artwork? Or is it kind of part of the fun having to collect them all?
Yeah, it definitely is part of the fun. Certainly doesn't frustrate me. In fact, I quite like the idea that there's a different version to collect. And in the most recent album, for example, there was three different colour variations of the vinyl release, which was fun to track down. But I haven't really been able to spot any regional variations, which is a bit disappointing. Because I would have liked to have tried to find out if there was a Japanese one and whether there's any bonus tracks, but there really isn't. It's nice to go and hunt them down. It's all part of the fun. It's just add something else to sort of look to source, I guess.
I asked Brian the same question.
Generally, I love it, except when it's impossible to get them all. Let's take DJ Shadow, for example. He gave away a 10-inch promo for Sad and Lonely at one of his gigs in Melbourne in 2011. Super happy to pick up the record. He did a Q&A. It was pretty cool. So I was pretty happy with that one. But on the flip side, the next year, he released Come and Riding Through the Cosmos, which is part of the Secret 7-inch project. Mm. So there's 100 copies, all with unique sleeves. So how's a collector going to get all those? As a completist, it's pretty hard to accept that sort of thing. Yeah.
While flicking through records in Shinjuku, I occasionally saw some which appeared to be exclusive to Japan. So are there any DJ Shadow items I should look out for?
There's not a huge amount. I was sort of mulling this over. The big one, I guess, that springs to mind is the four-track era collection. So that was a Studio Shadows online merch store sort of exclusive originally, where you bought a t-shirt and you got a free CD, like a limited edition CD with some old mixes from the early 90s. And then they released a box set of that with some t-shirts, being a limited edition box set, some stickers and whatnot, just only available from the online store. Three of the four CDs were then released later as a Japan exclusive, has unique artwork as well. Okay. And a three disc limited edition set, which is quite hard to find, fairly pricey. It's a nice little one if people can find it. There's also a few Mowax compilations that feature Shadow on there. I'm thinking of like Build and Destroy, Mo Groove, Ancient Overkill 8 box set with like Rock On and things in it. Mostly the Japan stuff is probably sort of promotional variations and stuff with unique artworks and things or track listings.
Thanks, Dave. I'll keep an eye out for those. But Brian, what about the Beastie Boys?
There's one item which I've never owned, and saying I never owned it without sounding arrogant, it means it was pretty rare because I was pretty obsessive with all this stuff. So I don't know if it's a record or it was a tour booklet, but basically I've only seen a picture once. It looked like a tour booklet. When I say booklet, it only had a few pages to it. It looks like it was to do with the 1987 Japanese tour for the Beastie Boys. The pictures that I saw looked like it may have been attached, you know, stapled or whatever to the front of the vinyl record, you know, if you bought it at that time. Like someone sent me some pictures saying, do I know anything about this? And I'd never seen it before. So I'd love someone to tell me what that's about. Some of the other, I mean, rarer Beastie Boys things for Japan, they had the very cute 3-inch CDs. So they had that for Get It Together. It came in the long sleeve, which I've seen for other Japanese 3-inch CDs. And it's only one of three mini CDs that were released for the band, the other two coming out of Austria. So that was pretty cool. Another cute one. I don't know why there's so many cute things in Japan. I think you should maybe do a podcast on that. But in 2005, this copy of License to Will released on CD, but in a vinyl sleeve. So it's a full 12-inch sleeve with a 5-inch CD sitting inside. Yeah, that's sort of cute. A bit novelty, I suppose, yeah. Then with your Mowax, I mean, there was a few fantastic compilations that were released in conjunction with the Japanese label Toys Factory. So you had James versus Nigo or Bathing Ape versus Mowax. The Art of War, both of those released from vinyl. They look awesome. I don't think they had exclusive tracks, but they had little skits in between them. And then they both had vinyl figures to promote them, which looked cool. What else? The Relax magazine sampler. Oh, and the 60 Minutes of Mowax Shit, mixed by Psychonauts. Super rare, exclusive mix. Can't get anywhere else except for Japan. So, yeah, they had some fantastic Japanese releases for Mowax.
Today is August 21st, which is the Japanese release of Science Fiction. And there was two or three different versions of the cover released in Japan, designed by Skate.
They were really thick, oversized, gatefold little CD sleeves. Yeah. I was back in Japan when that got released, purely by accident. And there was a display store, like at the Mega Virgin there, and it was like DJ Shadow and stuff, you know, listed all over. And it's like, I didn't even know what Uncle was at the time, but it was like, yeah, I'm picking this up, and got home and figured it out. I was like, wow, yeah. And then fell in love with Uncle.
Uncle is, of course, the project of James Lavelle, who founded Mowax Records and collaborated with Bape Clothing in Japan. If you'd like to read a translated interview from the 90s between James Lavelle and Bape founder Nigo, then head to our website, japanoscope.com. Speaking of the internet, Dave and Brian have both shared their collections online. While Brian helps build the Beastie Boys fan website Beastie Mania, Dave shares his collection with over 2,000 people via his Instagram page, the DJ Shadow Collection. So Dave, what inspired you to do that?
I guess originally sort of started just as a way to sort of catalogue what I was doing so I could see the sort of items I've got. So when I went out and saw other things, I thought it would be like a reference point, I guess. I tried to do it with online photo download stuff where it'd be sort of quite private. I think I had like a photo bucket account and I just uploaded loads of pictures onto there. Just so like when I was out and about, if I saw something, I could quickly sort of scroll to see whether I had it. But I don't know, I just felt like it'd be nice to sort of put out there. Mainly for me as that reference, but I did sort of and ah about it. I was a bit hesitant to put it up online and open it up that way. But, you know, since I've done it, I've really enjoyed it. I've been able to connect with all sorts of people that I may never have connected with before. So it's been good. I've been really pleased to have done it.
Are there many other collectors sharing their collection the same way?
Instagram's full of people that show collectors. In terms of people collecting the same stuff as me, there is probably a handful. I think it's probably 5 or 6 accounts maybe that do sort of shadow related stuff or Mowax type things.
Next, I asked Brian about Beastie Mania. which contains information on anything you'd want to know about the Beastie Boys and their collaborators, including one of the largest discographies online.
Mark started it, and it was just a static page, and that would have been late 90s, early 2000s. And then he contacted me because I had a massive collection, and then we brought a couple of guys together, and then it's just down to the fans coming along and offering us information or sending in tickets or sending us stuff that we don't have. We've had ex-Grand Royal people contact us and help us out. I don't know if you're into skateboarding, but one of the Bronze Brigade guys from the 80s, he contacted us once about it. I think because it's been there for so long, people know it's there, or, you know, to find the information they need, yeah.
Are you still getting people sending you stuff, or is it mainly you're looking to find stuff?
I've slowed down a bit on it, to be honest. I used to reach out to a lot more people. You know, someone might post something on Instagram, for example. Oh, and I'll contact them. Do you mind if we use this? But we still get regular emails, people coming in and, oh, stumbled across your site. Here's X, Y, and Z that you could use. So, yeah, that's cool. At one stage, there was a whole bunch of Beastie fan sites. And not so much anymore. Discogs replaces all the fan discographies out there. Setlist FM sort of replaces the gigographies on all the fan sites. So I suppose it's a bit harder to inspire people to make their own when there's so many corporations out there doing the same thing.
Finally, I wanted to know about the bonus tracks. As Dave mentioned earlier, Japanese editions of CDs often have one or two bonus tracks, which are sometimes unavailable outside of Japan, and make buying the Japanese editions even more appealing. So we asked Dave, does he have any favourite bonus tracks?
Most of the releases in the Japan pressings have had a bonus track. Nearly all of those tracks, I think, have probably seen their way out onto other releases now. Probably more at the time, I guess the ones that stood out probably would have been like Introducing and Preemptive Strike. Introducing had Influx on there, which at the time, probably the only place you were going to get that would have been on a 12-inch vinyl record. So that would have been nice to have. And Preemptive Strike would have had two rare tracks as well. There was a Cut Chemist remix of the Number song, and a Shadow remix of a Depeche Mode track, Painkiller. Both of those were only available at that time, either on a limited edition promotional record, which incidentally spanned a whole host of bootlegs. Those two tracks were only really available on Preemptive Strike Japan edition at that time, which is nice. I think Private Press might have a track called Flashback on it. That's only available there or on a sort of obscure promotional CD as well. The Mountain Before has Swerve on it. That, again, I don't think can be found anywhere else other than digitally.
I also asked Brian about the Beastie Boys and what are his favourite bonus tracks.
The one that jumps to mind is the Straight Outta Shibuya version of Right Right Now Now. It was released on a promo CDR and as an extra album track on the Solid Gold Hits compilation. So it's a totally exclusive Japanese track, and add to the fact it features Takaki Khan from Major Force, that's even cooler for me. Another one with bonus was, my pronunciations on all these words is going to be terrible, but Aglio e Olio, when it was released in the US, you know, it came out with 8 tracks. The Japanese version had an extra track, Sober Violence. Mind you, you could get that later on Sounds of Science compilation, but at the time it was only Japan and Australia. The Australian version had 2 extra tracks, a cover of Light My Fire with Miho Hattori, who was in Cyber Matter, another Japanese connection. And I don't know, we're talking to Japanese records, but Australian record was awesome. It wasn't cut on vinyl, it was cut on polycarbonate. It was lathe cut as well. I was lucky enough to meet the Beastie Boys in 2007, and I got them to sign that because it was Australian and it was cool and rare. So yeah, that's one I've kept for my own personal collection, yeah.
I think that one was cut in New Zealand as well.
It was, yeah, Peter King. I did an interview with him. He's sort of a reclusive guy, and he didn't have email. It was all handwritten letters that we had to correspond with. And I could be wrong here, but I'm pretty sure all the lathe cut, like it's one at a time, with and in real time. It's like, wow. I think it was 1,400 copies. I'm not sure how long that took. The sound's not great, but it looks cool.
So there you have it. While I'm unlikely to ever own 500 records like Brian once did, I can understand the appeal of buying records, especially from Japan. There's the exclusive artwork, the obi strip, bonus tracks, and even sometimes a sheet of translated lyrics. Handy for when your Japanese friends come to visit. But after walking around so many record stores in search of rarities for my friend, unfortunately, this time I was left empty-handed. But luckily, record stores are constantly getting new stock, so the hunt can continue next week. And perhaps I'll pick something up for myself. That Straight Outta Shibuya bonus track sounds cool. Or maybe DJ Shadow's The Private Repress, a compilation of remixes exclusive to Japan with a cute bird on the cover. There's so much to do in Japan, but more so, there's so much to buy. Until next time, Jamata, sayonara.
Okay, I hope you've enjoyed today's episode. Let us know if you like this sort of content around Japanese culture aside from Japanese language. Interested to hear your feedback. Hit subscribe if it's of interest. Thanks again to James, Brian and Dave. I'll put a link to all the places that you can follow them online below. Thanks for tuning in and we'll see you next time. Bye.